Good day to you, greetings.
Good day to you, greetings, and welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Tonight we are here
with author and activist, educator, Susan Anglada Bartley, with a different vision, a revolution against racism in public education. It's a new jam here out in 2018. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate, you know, you for the work you're doing, and everyone at Prison Pipeline for keeping the focus on the systemic brutality that is going on right now.
Well, thanks is all ours too. Can you talk about
how you got involved with all this?
Talk about the book. And general background.
I think it's important for me as a white woman to openly state that one of the key ways that I became involved in this is through my complicity in and my advantages and privileges that come with being part of white supremacy. I think that admission is really important for white people, and it's definitely important for me. My participation and the authorship of the book has also come from my education in history and literature of marginalized communities, but more than that, my experience in the public schools in the past 17 years. So, and my activism around racial justice in public education, all those things, as well as the continued brutality in the society, and really some more heartfelt moments. Like seeing a student go to prison, seeing students pass away, and experiencing those deaths. I definitely want to acknowledge a great mentor I had who is mentioned in the front of the book. His name is Dr. Charles Hobson, and he also passed away. He was a tremendous mentor, and he continues to be, because the knowledge that he dropped on me, I'm still realizing the things that he was trying to tell me, and I continue to be willing to be further educated.
Can you talk about your writing background as far as what kind of crescendoed into this particular book?
Yeah, I've been a writer, and I studied writing at NYU, and like I said, the history and literature of marginalized communities, and I also studied writing, but my activist writing, I have to thank Hampton Institute Working Class Think Tank, because I think I developed some courage through their, I don't know if I want to call it sponsorship, but their willingness to accept my voice. And so, I think the project was something that I had thought about engaging in. And I also had an amazing editorial team. I submitted the book originally to some major publishers and worked with a major publisher for 3 meetings, but they asked me to tone down my message about white supremacy and make it a book about classroom strategies, and I rejected that opportunity. You know, I told them I couldn't do it, and I set out for a different kind of project. And, you know, it is called a different vision, but I did hire an editorial team that was all either women or black people. And even the cover art is by an amazing artist named Idriss Wajid. And then I actually hired one of my former students, who's a graduate of Portland State University, Lamara Haynes, who is a phenomenal editor, and she had the last edit on the book. She's an incredible editor, writer, thinker, and I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to support her and allow her to have say in influence the book.
So let's get into the book here.
Right on.
To just tackle every single point in the book here. No, of course, we'll have you back and talk more about it and follow up. I'm sure you'll be writing more on this too. But in the title, it talks about racism. Inside the book, really, we're talking about white supremacy.
Yes.
And what I heard you saying is you already had that run-in with the publishing, and sometimes I shouldn't say sometimes. I think all the time these days, even the United States, you know, quote-unquote, come a long way here, and people still get very confused. I should say white people get very confused when we say white supremacy, and we're not talking about racism. What do you mean, white supremacy? Well, it's racism, but it's, you know, it's interesting how, you know, that almost has its own trigger. But as far as in context of the book, I mean, this is a crucial thread that relates to whiteness and white fragility, which is one of the things we wanted to talk about. So, I mean, maybe we start there and then get into all the other kind of threads of the isms and schisms behind this.
Absolutely. I think you're right to call out the term white supremacy, and I have heard some activists prefer to move toward white domination, while others say that white supremacy is something that we need to continue to use as a term. I use white supremacy and white domination, and I kind of wrote the book that way because my objective is to reach out to our my fellow educators, community members, activists, PTA parents, administrators, district leaders, and examine how our teaching forces in the United States are 82% at minimum white. So our system was designed by white people with the goal of upholding white people in society. And for me as an educator to walk into a classroom every day and ask students to sit in really a very authoritarian structure, in desks and often chairs that literally were designed in the late 50s. I'm not talking about updated. I'm talking about we still have those.
Yeah.
and then pretend that I'm afraid of the term white supremacy, even when I'm complicit and I'm taking a paycheck. I can't do that for my soul. So that's where that's coming from. And the kind of white supremacy I'm talking about is not necessarily the skinhead kind. It's not just necessarily the Donald Trump kind, though I think he would absolutely fit under the rubric of that term. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the Susie Anglada Bartley kind, the kind that would rather pretend it isn't that. And that actually, I think that I really want to encourage us away from the fragility that makes, I guess, white people, white women especially, prefer to feel as though they can exclude themselves from that term. So white exceptionalism. I'm not exceptional. I have profited from this supremacy, and this book is here to turn the tables and turn the mirror back on my fellow whites. I'm hoping that people of color could use it as a tool. One of my friends, Rebecca, she's a black woman, a multiracial woman in Buffalo, New York. I think now she's upstate, but she's an educator, and she asked me, do you have a book you'd recommend for a white teacher teaching kids of color? And I didn't have too many great recommendations, but I had this book on my mind, and I was going through the process with that publisher, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to make sure that book is available to you. So that's what it's supposed to be for.
Right. So when we talk about white fragility, and if you want to address even talking in the local context for Portland Public Schools and these kind of Band-Aids, if you will, like Courageous Conversations, where it's like we're going to buy all this book and then white people are just going to go home and cry or something. And, you know, and it really doesn't – it just plays on the white guilt and stuff. And but juxtaposed with that too, I mean, where are the kind of – you think the key mechanisms playing out and key – key figures or roles that people are playing within the system? You can speak to it globally or whatever, but you know.
Well, I really appreciate your question, and I do think that there is some brilliance in Glenn Singleton's work, Courageous Conversations. I do want to say that in my own experience, I asked a lot of my fellow teachers of color about their experience with it, and I refused to speak for them, so I'm not going to do that. However, I heard the most rejection of Courageous Conversations from white teachers around me. I do think that equity work that is needed to help white teachers move forward, and at the same time, I think what's needed even more is a major systemic completely tearing the roof off the, I won't say it on the air.
Thank you.
In order to completely reestablish the way that, that we educate children. And the ethos of the book is that white people like me cannot ultimately be the leaders of that. I'm here to tear the roof off the mother.
So, on that note, so we fleshed out a couple key themes here. And some other ones that come out in the book are this kind of hyper-policing that goes on among the teachers, the authoritarianism that comes out. So, again, kind of under the title of white supremacy, but what are, you know, what are the behaviors and stuff?
Thank
and so
you.
That's kind of another one, right? And then the exclusion piece.
So I think authoritarianism, it impacts white people and white children as well, in the sense that it is a systemic ordering of our humanity that actually is inhuman. It causes people to move through a system like, you know, something on a factory line. But what happens with authoritarianism in schools is it kind of works through humiliation, a culture of humiliation. And that humiliation, like calling out a child in class in front of other people, is exacerbated when the child is non-white. And we know that black children are three times more likely, this is from the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, three times more likely to be arrested than white students for the same infractions. And all of those statistics like that are in the book, where black children especially are being hyper-policed all over the country. And I have to also look at the impact on white children of that. How come, why isn't the conversation among white parents that I don't want my child to be complicit in racism? Why isn't that where we are? I personally don't get it, and I need us to get there. I am, in terms of fragility also, I think that I have seen both myself in the past and other white women move toward this fragility where I can turn on the tears, yet I could be insensitive and deny the reality that black mothers and brown mothers and indigenous mothers are experiencing in our system. So how is it that I could be so sensitive about some things and then I could be so insensitive about other things? That's what I'm asking my white sisters out there to drop the fragility and open up the sensitivity to our black mothers, our brown mothers, our indigenous mothers, our brown, black, indigenous fathers, and open up our hearts to that, not just so selfishly looking for what we want for our children. Looking at if we say we're colorblind, that's nonsense, okay, because the system isn't.
So if the idea is really dismantling things, and in this case, dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline, and this is prison pipeline, and what do you think it would need to – what do you think it would take? I mean, we talk about dismantling and kind of in a sense, though, what does that really mean? And I guess in that we can also just talk about, again, some of these other threads. So like – How is hyper policing happening?
Great.
How do we deconstruct that, for example? How can teachers give that up, you know, if they can be committed, which they all should be, to really dismantling that pipeline?
Well, I think it is a concern that restorative justice. See, I'm not gonna say that I know Senor Guerrero's plan, our superintendent. I'm not going to speak against something I don't know, but I do know that restorative justice and counselors, more counselors, less cops are, or no cops are important. And that the work that Resolutions Northwest here in Portland was doing related to restorative justice is important. I don't think that all of our teachers are trained or ready to do a relationships-based approach that restorative justice requires. And that is a very important feature. Shifting the power dynamic is one aspect of it in the classroom. But in terms of the book, there are chapters on how administrators can examine their practice, how teachers can, PTAs, the union itself, funding, testing, even our school buildings. So that's how the book is kind of laid out, to look at and examine each of those and ask people to ask more questions.
Folks just tuning in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline, coming to you from the studios of KBOO. And we're here with Susan Anglada Bartley, an author of A Different Vision, A Revolution Against Racism in Publication, in Education, excuse me. It's a great publication, though. So
thank you.
On the note of hyper-policing, because it's kind of a charged term that probably some folks, I mean, you know, might not be familiar with it all for one thing, okay? I mean, we can use context clues. But we're talking about a classroom here, so we're not just talking about hyper-policing in the community. What can you give us, can you talk about that a little bit, give us some kind of clear examples so people kind of understand, you know, we're talking about kind of the general issues here, but what are some examples people might not realize, like, what's going on in the classroom?
Yeah, and I guess for me, it's hard for me to accept that people don't know what's going on, because I'm seeing more and more visual images in my feed of Black children and the abuse that they suffer often in the classroom. I think that there's a nuanced spectrum of types of abuse, and we should be charting that, though we should really put our effort into ending that before we chart it. That's a very white thought, I think, that we would chart it. So excuse me. We need to end it. But I think also there's a lack of a systemic approach to complaints of discrimination and abuse. I've seen students. Here's an example. I can't be too specific in my examples, because I don't want to get in a situation where I'm saying something by name about a student or a teacher. But
we'll admit that.
And yeah, and I mean, believe me, I have written reports and I have passed them across the desks of people who should have done more. But I don't see it always happening. I see it very rarely happening, that a complaint of discrimination where a student feels as though they have been belittled or that something was directly said to them because of their race, I do not see that being addressed. I notice that our media here in Portland is looking into incidents of sexual harassment and abuse that have been ignored. I would like to have the conversation shift as well to cases of racial discrimination that have been totally ignored for many, many years in Portland, and I believe this is going on all the way across the country, from nuanced things to direct physical abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about exclusion?
So exclusion, that is also a broad term, and there's a spectrum of meanings. One is the exclusion of children of color and people of color from advanced opportunities. That's definitely happening across the country, and it's written about in the book. The exclusion from AP and IB classes, from, you know, things like constitution teams, any kind of advanced math and science. There are egregious problems across the country, starting really, unfortunately, from very early childhood.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about multicultural programming or multicultural curriculum in general and lack thereof?
So when I hear the word multiculturalism, I associate it with a movement that kind of came out of the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And I acknowledge that within the concept of multiculturalism, there are both benefits, and there was a place, I think, in that movement for people to stay in, I guess, what would you call the color blind approach, which I think is problematic. But when I think of really of ethnic studies and the importance of diversity in the way that we teach history and English and mathematics as well, and all of the subjects, art, everything, music, that's what I think. I think that we need an overhaul of the system overall. And God, please let me say it. We need more teachers of color. I can't forget to say that. But we need them to be able to come into environments where they'll be supported by staff members of color or by community members who are supportive and not marginalizing. So how do we look at our staff cultures?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, after looking at the book, there's some mentions, you know, here and there about you having students who, you know, have been a combination of, you know, arrested, locked up, jailed, whatever. So can you want to talk about that a little bit? I know that might be a little bit personal, but maybe even just a general sense of that.
I did just a couple weeks ago go down to Salem, and I went to visit the student that I write about in chapter one, and I, you know, I gave him a copy of the book, and we've been writing for years. He was placed in Pendleton a few years back, and if you can imagine the isolation in that prison for a black man, it's pretty amazing what he's gone through for an infraction that, honestly, there were some white students who were involved and didn't get punished at all. So this, what happened to him happened after he left high school, but I guess I should say white young people. It is painful, but again, I can't let my fragility make me not talk about what he's going through and what he's going to face when he comes out. He's going to face a different Portland when he comes out. Re-entry, it's such an important thing. I think you and I were talking about that before the show a little bit, how people re-enter the community and what resources are there. How can we make sure that those resources are there for this person when we come out? That's what's on my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that more students don't go in. Brilliant, a brilliant person.
Mm-hmm.
In there. Is there now, right now.
So you talked earlier about kind of how the book came together and the diverse kind of group of editors that you have and support around it. When it comes to putting together materials about the book, I mean, aside from just that you have the, you know, the personal, you know, kind of life journey around this issue, but as far as, you know, materials, I mean, not to just, you know, name drop authors per se, but we're talking about different kind of resources or, like, how are people, like, getting involved and engaging with this? Because, of course, this is a book, but, right, the idea is, right, that's going to, you know, there's practical use there. And where, if any, you know, is it kind of playing out? Or maybe that's on you and things that you're doing in the community.
Yeah, well, I'm really grateful to say that there is a community of educators in Evergreen who have created a book group. And shout out to those Evergreen teachers who are committed and on their own actually engaging with this book.
Where's Evergreen?
Evergreen, Washington. Evergreen School District.
Okay.
Yeah, and then in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Nicole. Thank you so much.
Shout out.
And to Coach East. Thank you, family. There's another community of educators in Buffalo, New York, already using the book for a book group. And those kinds of things are extremely exciting, and I'm so grateful that they're happening on their own. And there are some events I'd love to share that are coming up for people to get involved, too.
Sounds like a great segue.
Okay. All right. So, first of all, June 22nd at the Portland Mercado from 7 to 10. That's the book launch. Faya and Saida Wright and Damo Brandt are all going to be sharing their music. Poet Mercedes Munoz and Rochelle Hart are going to be offering up poems on this topic of racism in public education. And so, I'm really excited that they're going to be taking the mic. July 17th, Resolutions Northwest is sponsoring a reading at the North Portland Library, and my former student, Hector Cañedo Sanchez, as well as community activist Sunny Justice, will be, I've asked if they would please read the book and critique, including positive critiques, but I'm also very much open to what they have to say about the book in an unscripted fashion. So what would they pick? What do they want to elevate? What's important to them? August 16th, Powell's Books. Thank the independent book buyer, Adam, at Powell's Books. 7:30 p.m., August 16th, and Sheila Warren, Portland activist Sheila Warren, will be speaking there as well, and I'll be doing a reading and signing. And then August 18th, with Portland Parent Union, which you can find on Facebook or on the website for Portland Parent Union, that's Sheila Warren's group. August 18th is the Counselors Not Cops event. And so those are all events that you can get involved in. I'm looking at this as a movement, not just as a one-time thing, something that is a place for the voices of community members of various communities, the Latino community, Indigenous community, and Asian diaspora, and Black community here in Portland, to engage and speak and express themselves. And I really, really need the support of white Portlanders who are willing to take a listening and learning approach and examine our complicity.
And for folks who are anywhere in the world, and matches in Portland, Oregon, looking for the book itself, what's going to be the quickest way to find that on your website?
I want it. Yeah, there is, guess what? Strand Books in New York City carries the book. Thank you, Strand. Talking Leaves Books in Buffalo, New York. I think Burning Books has some of the book. And then Powell's, the first major bookstore to carry it. Those would be wonderful if you could support those independent sources. I'm pretty sure you can order online from Powell's or any of those stores. It is available on Amazon as well, but here we are at Prison Pipeline Radio. Let's support independent bookstores.
Right. And it's also linked to your website, which is
SusanAnglatabartley.org.
Okay. Thanks for sharing all that with the book. Do you want to say any kind of last things?
Just to wrap it up here.
Yeah. I think I just want to encourage friends especially fellow whites, to move, not just to guilt. From guilt to fragility. From guilt to responsibility, to reflection, to learning, to lifelong learning. And to really having the courage to reject the structures of white supremacy in the first examination. I really appreciate you picking up my book, Different Vision, A Revolution Against Racism in Public Education.
Right on. I hope to have you on again and kind of follow up and see where things are moving.
Thanks so much for everything you're doing in the community. I really appreciate that.
So you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, coming from the studios of KBOO.
Here with our amazing guest,
we want to thank Susan Aglada-Bartley, again, author of A Different Vision, A Revolution Against Racism in Public Education.
Find a copy. Share it with people.
Start groups around this. This is crucial.
Of course, listen to this in previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/Prison Pipeline.
Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook.
Thanks to our amazing Man Wonder,
Mr. Michael Fictalis. Thanks for tuning in. Free them all.